All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a packed show today. Towards the back end of the show, we're going to be joined by Alan Blumenfeld and Mark Cecil, actors in a play called Cherry Docks. It's a play about a Nazi skinhead who's accused of a racially motivated murder and being defended by a liberal court-appointed Jewish lawyer. And it's a lot of wrestling there, so we'll stay tuned for that one. That's at the back end of the show. Before that, we'll be talking with Sandra Thomas. Sandra's the mother of Alicia Thomas, a young woman murdered by the LAPD while in police custody on July 22, 2012. She was murdered for supposedly dropping her kids off at the police station and saying she couldn't take care of them anymore, going home, and then the police came to arrest her for child endangerment. And then they killed her. All right, so we're going to be talking with Sandra Thomas, Alicia Thomas's mother. But opening the show up, I'm really happy to welcome back Larry Everest. Larry is a journalist with Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda. And Larry specializes in covering the Middle East. He's traveled to Iran twice. He's been to other parts of the Middle East over the years. And he recently was talking with me about the situation that's in the Middle East right now, the whole thing that's, you know, you look at what's happened, and there's all kinds of upheaval that we've seen, you know, since the first uprisings in Tunisia, in Egypt. The region has been just like hopping with upheaval. But the character of all this has changed dramatically. A little while ago, this was all about people fighting to be free, and people were very inspired around the world by what happened when the Egyptian people rose up and drove out the Mubarak regime, similarly in Tunisia. But now there seems to be the entire area is in flames, and there's a lot of confusion about just what the hell is going on there, and how should people look at that, and what should we do in the face of that? And I invited Larry back to talk about that. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you.
Let's jump into this right away, man. Like I was saying, there's all kinds of things that are going on in the Middle East, massive protests across the region against the distribution of that clip of the film made by these various religious maniacs in this country, Christian maniacs in this country, that have been described as being aimed at grotesquely and gratuitously offending Muslims. And then there's these, you know, what's going on in Syria, the civil war in Syria, and the threats of war against Iran. Now, let's talk about how the hell do people figure this out? What is going on here? What can you explain about what's the situation in the Middle East right now?
Well, the crucial thing people need to understand is a basic overview of the forces driving this. And at Revolution, we worked up an article that's in this week's paper called Three Things You Need to Know About the Background for Events in the Middle East and North Africa. And we're trying to get to the root and driving dynamics of the situation, not start the movie in the middle like the U.S. media does. Oh, something happened to a U.S. embassy. That's the beginning of the story. Forget about what happened in the years before that. So the article, I really recommend it to people. It makes three points. First, let's start with the overarching framework that has been the main thing shaping things in the Middle East for 70 years and more. And that's this. And I think it's the most succinct and scientific kind of concentration I've read. What it is the essence of what exists in the U.S. is not democracy, but capitalism, imperialism, and political structures to enforce that capitalism, imperialism. What the U.S. spreads around the world, and I'm adding including the Middle East, is not democracy, but imperialism and political structures to enforce that imperialism. And then the second point we made is in this context, over the past decades, we've seen the rise of Islamic fundamentalism as a political ideological force that basically seeks to reimpose Islamic law and practices as the governing ideology and law within this imperialist-dominated setup. But this clash between this outmoded Islamic fundamentalism and outmoded imperialism has shaped a lot of the dynamics, and we're seeing that now. And of course, it's crucial to understand that these two reactionary poles actually reinforce each other even as they clash. And then the third point that was made in the article was that right now it is very urgent to bring forward a radically different liberating path that's neither imperialism nor religious fundamentalism, but aims to uproot oppression and liberate humanity.
Well, let's jump into this because I'm sure people are wondering, you know, that's a lot for people to bite into in one big chunk. And I'm kind of curious, and when you talk about what the essence of what exists in the U.S. is not democracy and what it sends out all over the world is not democracy, but capitalism, imperialism, and political structures to enforce that imperialism, you know, how does that play out in this region?
Well, that's a quote from Bob Avakian's Basics. And if you look at any country, go to any country in the Middle East, go to Wikipedia and look at the history, and you're going to find the bloody tracks of the U.S. Take Egypt, which has been an inspiration for people around the region, one of the first countries that overthrew this tyrant, Hosni Mubarak. Well, he was put in power and backed by the U.S. for 30 years. This was a political structure, his military dictatorship, that supported the political, economic, and military interests of U.S. imperialism in the Middle East. It was a key element, a key piece of the U.S.'s structure of domination in the whole region. Okay, that's a military dictatorship. We can go turn to Saudi Arabia. That's a religious fundamentalist monarchy. That, too, is a political structure that has been backed to the hilt by the U.S. in order, of course, to control and protect the flow of oil and, again, U.S. domination of that entire region. And, of course, this is a reactionary religious tyranny that prohibits women from public activity, that recently crushed the democratic uprising of people in Bahrain. We could talk about U.S. support for Israel, which is based on dispossessing the Palestinian people and is certainly suppressing the national and democratic aspirations of the Palestinians. We can even look in Iraq, the much vaunted vote, waving the purple finger. But this, too, is a political structure dominated by and serving the interests of imperialism. And so anywhere you go in this region, and you can go back to the British and the French who drew up the borders in the area, and you will see that imperialism and colonialism have been the main forces shaping the terrain there.
All right. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper. And we're talking about the sort of understanding the background of what's going on in North Africa and the Middle East as a way of understanding what we should actually, how we should be looking at this, how we should analyze this, and who to stand with and what to do in terms of, you know, in relation to all these, to this uproar that's just rocking the Middle East, and to understand what's behind it. Now, Larry, one of the things that you go on in that second point, and I guess it's the second point that's quoted by Avakian, but you go on in this point talking about the dynamic that's shaping the region being a clash of outmoded reactionary forces. You know, and people are looking at this, and it is, for the most part, everywhere in the Middle East and in North Africa, where there's this massive upheaval going on, there is at least, at the very least, a significant element of that is Islamic fundamentalism. Let's talk, and that's a change from what people maybe historically are used to, you know, back in the latter part of the 20th century. This is a major change in the shape of the world, in the dynamic that's actually shaping a lot of the struggles in the oppressed world.
Well, it is. I mean, the people of the Middle East have a long and proud history of very courageous struggle against imperialism and colonialism in Iran, in Egypt, in Iraq, in Palestine, wherever you turn. And today, the uprisings that have began in December 2010 in Tunisia have spread are a very powerful expression of this, and millions of people involved in these uprisings are seeking real liberation. But as you've said, the political train in the region in the last several decades has seen this rise of Islamic fundamentalism and this reactionary ideology as a big force on the terrain. And one of the reasons for this was a very serious setback for genuine revolutionary forces. Since the death of Mao in China and the defeat of socialism and the reimposition of capitalism there in 1976, this had an enormous and very terrible impact on the global political political terrain. And of course, now there are revolutionary communists, the Revolutionary Communist Party, Bob Avakian, and others who are fighting to bring forward a new stage of communism. But still, this Islamic fundamentalism is a very pronounced feature in the Middle East. Another thing that has really accelerated and brought forward this development is acceleration of globalization over the past 50 years. I mean, you've had the uprooting of tens of millions of peasants and farmers from the countryside thrown into these shanty towns, displaced, dislodged from their traditional social, family, cultural relationships, and really subject to the most brutal kinds of oppression and poverty. I mean, I've seen these shanty towns in India, in Iran, in Iraq, throughout the region. And in these conditions, there's been both a spontaneous development to try to cling to the practices of the past, the anchors of the past, as well as direct U.S. support and sponsorship for these reactionary Islamist trends, from Hamas to the Taliban in Afghanistan in the 80s. Even in Iran, the U.S. gave tacit support to the Khomeini forces in 1979 because they would rather have them take power than allow that revolution to get further radicalized. So this is certainly a big feature of what's happened. And fundamentally, this ideology represents outmoded strata, you know, the property, the landed classes, the capitalist class in these oppressed countries that want to reshape the terms. They're not seeking to break out of this whole global capitalism imperialism, but more assert their interest. And this has come into very sharp conflict with what the direction the U.S. wants to take the region.
All right. Now, Larry, we have about 5 more minutes. I have a couple of other questions I'd like you to speak to. And one is just looking at, because this has been very hot in the news, and one of the things that's really threatening to take things to a whole different place in the world today is what's happening in relation to Iran, and specifically in terms of the U.S. and Israel. Why don't we talk about that? Iran's one of those places where this second outmoded force actually did come to power, and people can see what's happened as a result of that. But then there's a question of, now we have Iran being threatened by the U.S. and Israel. What's going on there?
Well, that goes back to this first point. What the U.S. exports is capitalism, imperialism, and political structures to support that. The problem, the U.S. and Israel are waging this covert war and a propaganda war against Iran in the name of preventing nuclear catastrophe and bringing democracy to Iran. That's not what they're doing. They don't have any problem with the fact that the Islamic Republic is a reactionary theocracy. Look across the Persian Gulf. Saudi Arabia is a reactionary theocracy as well. Nor is the U.S. and Israel seeking to eliminate nuclear weapons from the region. In fact, they are the powers that have brought nuclear weapons into the Middle East. What they are trying to do is contain, weaken, and ultimately topple the Islamic Republic because it's an impediment to their regional political and military hegemony and to the overall imperialist domination by the U.S. and its gendarme in the region, Israel. That's what that clash is about.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the sort of understanding the background of what's going on in North Africa and the Middle East. All right, well, let's talk about this, because this is something, as I said, that presents the, you know, this whole thing that you've been talking about presents the people of the world with, you know, people are looking at this and trying to figure out, well, what the hell do we do in relation to this? And in particular, we're talking about this clash in relation to Iran and the goals of the U.S. and Israel. What should, you know, there's a real danger of war developing there. And you're talking about, you know, what would you say in terms of, I know you've mentioned this thing about people have to really look for and support something that's in opposition to all of those things to bring forward a whole new revolutionary path, basically. Talk about that a little bit. What do you mean by that? What do you think people can do?
Well, let's look. What are the sources of oppression that people face? They face poverty and suffering because of the workings of global capitalism imperialism. They face horrific wars because of the military domination of the United States and Israel. They face torture and brutality at the hands of either Islamist regimes or these U.S.-backed military or other forms of U.S.-backed rule. Women throughout the region face the horrific impact of patriarchy and religious strictures. So these are the things that need to be uprooted, defeated and uprooted. That's got to drive the people's struggle. And that is in part what has inspired people to rise up. There are currents of those in the region, but they have to be greatly strengthened. And I think one thing that is very important, when those kinds of forces emerge, they need to be supported. For example, the political prisoners from Iran that you have had and interviewed on your show who are against both war and Islamic fundamentalism. Second, people in this country have a very, very important role to play. If there's a visible force in the U.S. that rejects all these crimes and justifications and pretexts by the U.S. imperialists and opposes this government, that sets a lot better condition for real liberatory forces to emerge and dig deeply into the solution to this, which in my view is revolution, socialism, and communism. And I think sort of the best concentration of how to bring forward a new stage of this revolution, of the communist revolution, is the manifesto from the RCP titled Communism, the Beginning of a New Stage. And this kind of sums up the whole sweep of the Marxist and communist project from Marx through Lenin, Mao, and to this new synthesis of Achaeans brought forward, and lays out really the theoretical and political framework for really bringing forward another way that can really uproot the horrors and the oppression that people are facing throughout the Middle East and throughout the world. And
all right, Larry, thank you very much. We have just run out of time, man.
Okay. All right. There you go, man. Yeah. Take care.
Well, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I've been talking with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper. And you can read Larry's work, including the article he was referring to that was written in Revolution Newspaper. You can read it at revcom.us. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Sandra Thomas, the mother of Alicia Thomas, who was murdered by the LAPD back in July. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That's Otis Taylor with Gonna Buy Myself Some Freedom. Joining us now is Sandra Thomas. Sandra's the mother of Alicia Thomas, who was 35 years old. She was arrested on July 22nd of this year for leaving her children at a police station. A few hours after that, Alicia was dead in the backseat of an LAPD car. Sandra's here to talk with us about that. Sandra, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, definitely. Well, why don't we talk about what actually happened that day, what you understand happened to your daughter?
My daughter was killed by the LAPD. She hadn't done anything wrong. She just wasn't feeling well, and she felt that since I live so far in Temple City and she lives in L.A., grandmother wouldn't keep the kids for her. So she decided she wanted to take him to the police department and have my grandson have the desk officer give me a call so I can pick them up. And what the officers did, she waited until they were inside, and then she went on home. What the officers did before they could think first, they acted. They, instead of saying, well, this lady's probably not feeling well, let's call her mother and find out what the problem is. You know, have her to come and get the kids, and then have her to talk to her daughter and find out what's wrong with her. Why can't she keep the kids? She went home. She didn't do anything illegal. She brought the kids and asked them to, on the note, to call grandma to pick them up. And they went out, volunteered without thinking, and just approached her wrong and told her she was under arrest for what? Nothing. She didn't abandon her kids. She didn't do any neglect, child neglect. How could it be abandonment if she bring them to a place that's supposed to be a safe haven? And that's the place that normally people go when they have serious problems to seek for help.
And the problem is that normally when they go to this place to seek for help, they get a bigger problem because you think about this, and this is what happens with the police all the time. You know what?
They said on television, bring your kids to the police department or to safe haven where someone can take them over and get help for them. Okay, now just from this and watching it on television, I'm sure a lot of people will be afraid to take their kids there now.
And rightfully so. I mean, let's be clear. It's very interesting because none of this is what you're saying actually comes out in any of the official stories, in any of the police stories, any of this. None of this comes out. You know, you have a situation where your daughter, Alicia, took her children to the police station and, you know, doing what actually people are encouraged to do all the time. And then what happens is they end up, the police go after her for supposedly endangering the lives of the children. When they get there, the confrontation seemed to me it was pretty heavy what happened with her, because when they got there, they didn't just knock on the door and say, hey, we'd like an explanation. They, in fact, proceeded to attempt to arrest her,
knock her to the ground, handcuffed her, and going to give her water. And then a lady tells her, a police officer, I don't know what was wrong with that lady that day. She was at work, and she was frustrated, had some personal problems at home. She took all of her anger out on my daughter. And that heavy beating is what killed my daughter. My daughter took the kids there for a reason. She evidently wasn't feeling well or strong, you know? So I never told my daughter about police brutality because it was really bad in 1987, and before that, I never explained those things that were going on. And back in the day, these kids are young; they don't really realize how some police can approach you and do wrong things to you just because they have that badge and they put it in their minds they can just take the law and fix it the way they want it, you know, approach people. Mm-hmm. That's not right. It's not true. But that's what they do anyway.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sandra Thomas, the mother of Alicia Thomas, who was killed by the Los Angeles Police Department back in July. Alicia was a 35-year-old black woman who needed help, and instead what she got was her place in a long and growing line of people murdered by the police. Here's the point. It brings up the question of the role of the police, because I tell you, you know, if you think if your daughter, you know, your daughter was clearly had some problems. She was trying to figure out what to do with her kids. She didn't want to endanger the kids. She takes them to the police station, you know, and then they come to your daughter's house. And instead of coming with like medical care or with some, you know, some attempt to actually investigate and figure out, is there a way they can actually help solve this? The first thing they do is they grab her, wrestle her to the floor in the hallway there, and they even the modern version of hog tying her, what they call a hobbling, where they wrap straps around her, you know, her legs and handcuff her behind the back and all this. And then they and that's, you know, it's what they use instead of hog tying now. But here's the thing is, you would think that what they would have done, you know, if they really had to serve to help people, they would have come and done acted completely differently.
How can they do that when they grabbed my daughter and they heard her tell them she can't, her heart was hurting and she couldn't walk anymore before they hogtied her. They hogtied her anyway instead of calling the paramedics for her and took her and then beat her after that too.
Yeah, when you say
why she died.
Right, and when you say beat her, let's be clear. They kicked her in the genitals.
At that lady. How could a lady put it in her mind to even suggest doing something to another woman like that? A police lady. She's no man. I mean, even if it's wrong, definitely, I don't even think a man would even think that, to do something like that, an officer. But this lady was really violent. She was a monster. And she needs the electric chair. That's what she needs. Well, the rest of them need to be put in jail, accessory to her death.
That's an important stand to take in relation to this, because one of the things that they always do in cases like this is they not only murder the person first, then they turn around and they assassinate them again by assassinating their character, their reputation. And you, in your daughter's case, you know, there was all kinds of stuff put out there. Well, your daughter was a drug addict. Your daughter was this. Your daughter was that. She was incapable of taking care of anything. You know, can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, that must have really gotten you angry.
The thing is, they cannot put a drugs or anything to justify for what they're doing, what they did to her. They can't do that because drugs, and you know what? People take medicines, the doctor prescribes them all the time. And some medication can be kind of strong for you, too. I've had some medication the doctor gave me, and it made me see dots before my eyes. If you, whatever it was, they still took the wrong approach to see what was wrong with this lady. You know, they could have had a worker, a peace officer, go over there rather than the group, the team that went over there. They should have had a worker speak to her. They should have, you know, it should have been a different way they handled that matter. It was very wrong. Mm-hmm. And they should have a meeting and try to, when they have these type of situations come up, they should have a special tactic to handle these, to approach these, to address these little incidents when it have come to someone bringing their child to the office. That wasn't a case where someone was threatened to be killed or she was the one that was killed for trying to seek help.
Right around that same time, the guy who was skateboarding out in Venice gets the hell beaten out of him. The woman out in the valley somewhere who the police stopped and she, for talking on a cell phone, and they slammed her again down on the ground, slammed her head and her face down on the ground a couple times. You know, there's this constant repetition and the number of police killings that seem to continue to just climb and climb and climb. You really put this all together and there is an entire campaign that's very much related to a sort of genocidal campaign against the oppressed people in this society. You know, one of the things I was going to ask you about was, you know, this whole thing, what they did to your daughter was actually filmed by a dashboard camera. Have you seen the film?
We're waiting for them to show us the film. The public needs to see that film. Everybody else's film has been shown. The lady that, the little nurse who had her cell phone, that was shown. The skateboard guy with the skateboard, that was shown. What's taking so long with this little investigation? They need to show that film so everyone else can see who it was that done it. I've been often asked, the ethnicity of the person kicking my daughter. That's an interesting question. It doesn't make any difference with the ethnicity, but still, everyone wants to know. That's a question, too. The police department, they, you know, they can't replace the use of drugs or alcohol for her death. It was the police beating and kicking that Alicia couldn't take.
That's extremely important, Sandra. I can't emphasize that enough. You know, the way that they raise this is as if even if your daughter had been using drugs or had been taking medication or anything else, as if that would warrant the death penalty against her.
I don't know what's taking them so long. What's taking them so long with this investigation? It's nothing to investigate. She got killed by them. Who are they going to investigate? Themselves? Everybody know what happened? Why don't they show that video?
Mm-hmm.
They need to show the video. It'll speak for itself.
Mm-hmm. So where do things stand now, Sandra?
We're waiting for the investigation to be complete. And we want to see this video. They need to give that video up.
And when you talk...
What are they hiding?
Mm-hmm.
They're hiding something.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about getting justice for Alicia, what do you mean by that?
I want everyone to see how wrong this L.A. Police Department is handling their police officers. They need to refresh. They need to start all over again training these police officers. They need to make sure what type of people they are putting in this police department. Too many people nowadays do not care to be involved with the police. They don't care anything for them, and that's really bad when you can't have, you know, you have to enforce a law some way. We have to have rules. But the police, like them, they cannot work with the public again. They should never be allowed to work with the public.
Well, tell me, what do you think should happen to the police? What would you want to happen with regards to the police?
I would like to see them. I want them in jail, fired, never to work with the public again. That female officer, she need to be electrocuted. She need to be electric chair.
Sandra, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay.
Okay,
well.
Take care now.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, we were just talking with Sandra Thomas, the mother of 35-year-old Alicia Thomas, who was murdered by the LAPD on July 22nd for leaving her children at a police station because she didn't feel she could care for them as it was needed. And they went and beat her to death, basically. You know, and I think actually when you listen to this, it reminds you, it makes me think again and again and again about the nature of the police in the society. And we need to step up against that. And as a point of information, I think it's important for people to know that October 22nd, which is a day for people to step out on a nationwide scale and as strong as possible to say no to this police brutality. One of the things that's come up again and again and again, constant news, new news about the Trayvon Martin murder. Most recently, the point that was raised about George Zimmerman, where they only found Zimmerman's DNA on the gun, not any of Trayvon's DNA. Well, I received this poem from Reggie Gaines, and it's called Song for Gordy 2. And I want people to hear that. I think it's a very, very, very important and moving poem in honor of Trayvon Martin. So check this out.
With my dad at his girlfriend's, watching the All-Star game. Dwayne Wade, LeBron, Kobe, going insane. But Durant's jump shot is hot. Halftime. West up 88-69. Bored with Pitbull's tired rhyme, so I head to 7-Eleven, see what they got. A bag of Skittles, a can of iced tea. My lady calls my celly, I say someone's following me. Got no ID. Guess I'm wrong color to B-boy, to B-boy, to be boy in this hoodie in the rain. In an instant, I feel a Malcolm X-like pain. Shot point blank in my chest. And I guess I'll never know who won the game.
All right, that was Reggie Gaines with Song for Gordy 2 in honor of Trayvon Martin. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with two people that drove me nuts last night, okay? And they are the people who are the two main characters in Cherry Doxin. I'll tell you what that's about when you come back, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back. I'm Michael Slate, and that was Lester Bowie and Brass Fantasy with Black or White. God, it's a great song. Someday I'll play the whole song. I'm going to play all these songs all the way through someday. All right, joining us now is Alan Blumenfeld and Mark Cecil, actors in Cherry Docks. And Cherry Docks is a play that will knock your socks off. It's about I'm going to have my guests actually tell you what it's about. Alan Blumenfeld, sorry, Mark Cecil. It's been a confusing day, okay, so far, and it's only just beginning. Why don't you tell us what the play's about?
Well, basically, it's about a neo-Nazi skinhead who kicks a South Asian man to death and is assigned a Jewish public defender to defend him. It's a Canadian play. The law in Canada is slightly different from the law in the United States, but basically, it's about these two men wrestling with their conscience, their ethics, their morality, and learning from and being transformed by one another.
So that's your opinion, Mr. Lawyer.
Yes, sir.
Mark, your opinion. What's the story here?
The story is my character, Mike, finds himself in a holding cell, and he's charged with which is essentially a hate crime. Those terms never come up in the play, but he's in a bad situation. He knows he's committed a horrific act, but it's backed by an ideology that encourages his actions. And Mike makes it very clear in the first scene that he says he wants to be tried as an individual and doesn't want the ideology of his movement to be put on trial. So right there you have a real moral wrestling match that begins. And the play on the whole, to me, is an examination of prejudice in all its forms, not just the ones that are easily identifiable by a shaved head and certain tattoos, which Mike does have. But also we find in Danny, the lawyer, the more liberal, quote-unquote, member of the show, we find that he's wrestling with his own assumptions about humanity and those he encounters. So it's really a compelling piece. It knocked my socks off the first time I read it, and I immediately had to reread it when I knew I wanted to audition for this part. And just the provocative language and theology and philosophies that are addressed, both that take it from a personal level to a more universal understanding of who we are as a people. And I think that with these two men kind of grappling with their own flaws and their own hubris it's been a lot of fun. And I don't want to tell you exactly what happens, but there's huge transformations on both parts, both characters.
Well, let me make it clear to the audience as well that Mark plays the neo-Nazi skinhead and Alan plays the multicultural, in his own definition,
exactly,
multicultural, liberal, Jewish attorney appointed to defend Mark. Now, one of the things that happens is it's interesting because there is a lot. You know, while it doesn't, one of the things that pleased me about the play is it didn't seek common ground. I was very concerned about that mm-hmm. sort of, you know, because it's become so, you know, this is the what you do these days is you seek common ground. When actually, if you seek common ground with Nazis, you're in big trouble.
Absolutely.
You know, if you seek common ground with Christian fundamentalists, you're in big trouble.
Exactly.
You know? So there's a whole point here, you know, that this play, and I was very concerned about that, but then I thought the intensity of it came out a lot in the fact that neither one of you was actually looking for common ground. There was something very different going on.
I completely agree. And in fact, one of the things that was most pleasing and rewarding to me when I read it was it's not a simple solution. Not only don't they seek common ground, but there's not like you hear about it and you think, oh, you know, what's going to happen is the higher moral height of Jewish liberal religious secular point of view is going to overcome this skinhead and he's going to see the error of his ways and we're going to end with this big kumbaya moment. But indeed, not at all. It's very ambiguous at the ending. Both men end up very differently from how you think. There's no simple solution. There's no simple ending. Both of them wrestle. And my character, Danny, talks about threading a very, very fine needle, going through the eye of a needle. And both men seem to go through the eye of a needle and emerge on the other end in opposite ways. And the experience of grappling with one another really changes them both. And I mean, I don't want to give away, again, the ending. As Mark said, we don't want to say what happens, but the men, especially the Jewish lawyer, does not end up at all the way you would think he does. And I think hubris is a word Mark used. I think there's some hubris in Danny's character. I think he comes from a religious background where tikkun olam, mending the world, mm-hmm. is real to him. And he also, I think, has some arrogance and hubris that I can change this guy. I can reach him. I can make him see the error of his ways. And, you know, not only does he not reach common ground, but he barely gets that, although he does push for some, as he says, some form of redemption, a small piece of redemption for this guy.
And I think you see the hubris in Michael emerge in the first scene, and this isn't to give anything away, but one thing that Mike says is, I want you on this case because of your ideology, because you are a liberal humanist Jew. He says, so you have to do your very best, and then delivers the one of my favorite lines, because it's just so straight out of white power propaganda. He says, in an ideal world, I'd see you eliminated, but in this world, I need you more than anyone. So you can tell he's keenly aware of his circumstances and the situation he's in, but it's backed by this prejudice that says, okay, my best shot at this is to ally with my enemy, you know. And
yeah, I'm in trouble. I'm going to get me a good Jew lawyer to get me off. You know, I mean.
Yeah. Let me remind listeners once again that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Alan Blumenfeld and Mark Cecil from the play Cherry Docks. One of the things I actually wanted to ask you guys, when you're talking about, there is an element of where each one of you is very much using the other in the sense of, you know, and because it's not even a question of, you know, what ultimately comes out in terms of all the transformations that take place. But there's really an element of, I mean, Alan, your character is, there's a lot of ego involved in
this. Absolutely.
And similarly with yours, Mark, you have a program, and a point that you don't want your program touched.
Yes.
You know, you don't want your ideological position touched. You want the crime to be the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And you admit to the crime, and you're like, okay, so we have to, this is what you have to defend me on. And I was kind of thinking, how, you know, there's another question that gets, in addition to both of you having your own goals, there's also something else that doesn't get really, it's an undercurrent in the play, which, but I think is really important today, especially given the way this, you know, nobody's being prosecuted for torture and nobody's being prosecuted for all these other things. And then there's this point about the rule of law to a certain extent, because there actually is, you know, a question of how do you look at a skinhead who's done this? You know, and then it's like, and he's saying, don't go after my ideology, go after my crime.
Right.
You know, how did you guys deal with that?
Well, I mean, this is one of the issues, is you have to take responsibility for your actions. You have to take responsibility for your behavior. And I think Danny, my character, the lawyer, he wants Mike to take responsibility. He wants Mike to, you can't go free. You have to be punished. You did a horrible thing. He said, you killed someone. Deliberately. You hurt someone deliberately and he died. You're in a stinking mess. So you'll be lucky if you get convicted of manslaughter, and much more likely it'll be second-degree murder. You have to have some mitigation. And in Canadian law, it's slightly different from American law. But nonetheless, you know, Danny's looking, the lawyer is looking for Mike to admit it, to take responsibility, and more importantly, to get in touch with his feelings.
Yeah.
What's underlying this? Why did this happen? Why did you kill someone? Get this man, this unrepentant skinhead, this hate-filled creature, to get in touch with his feelings. He says, Danny says to him, explain why you killed someone. How did it happen? What the hell was wrong with you? And that issue, forcing someone to deal with that, I think, like you said, about no one getting prosecuted for all the torture, that torture now seems to be something that, as a government, we, if not condone, at least look the other way, and we outsource. So the societal issue is, we need to look at what the hell happened to us as a people. How do we feel about that? We need to confront these questions, and they're not easy.
How are we essentially, you know, from birth, in a way, pre-programmed to hate or to assume something negative about someone who looks differently than us. You know, there's 23 chromosomes in the DNA strand, and I think only two of them are responsible for – I could be wrong on this. Correct me. But I think only two of them are responsible for things like eye color, skin color, those things that as a society we look at and you know, cling to this sense of fear. And I think that's really what is underlying a lot of Mike's tension is a fear that his country's being taken away, that his job opportunities are being taken away. And a lot of that is fed in through this programming that emerges, you know, that really took hold, of course, after the Second World War. But what it is more than anything is a realization that Danny is trying to bring out of Mike, that you know we're all human, that we're all in this together, and does he recognize that or not?
I mean, it's interesting, you know, as a society. I mean, we talked certainly in rehearsal about the larger social issues. We talked about how you take responsibility. We talked about what is punishment. We talked about retribution. We talked about a lot of things. As actors, when you approach a play, a lot of that conversation is not necessarily helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to talk about, and certainly I believe an intelligent actor, a thoughtful actor, is a better actor. An informed, educated actor is a better actor. But when you're approaching the character, you have to be off standard. As the actor, you cannot have judgment. You have to approach the character and embrace and wrap your mind and heart and body around that point of view and accept that as your point of view of the world. And then from those circumstances, you have to figure out, well, what is it you're trying to do and what is it you're trying to achieve? So the global issues that you're talking about and that we're talking about now, these are very important, but eventually they have to siphon down and be put away.
And let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Alan Blumenfeld and Mark Cecil, two of the actors in the play Cherry Docks. It's about what happens when a white liberal Jewish attorney is asked to defend a Nazi skinhead accused of murdering a South Asian immigrant. Well, let me ask you this, and it's a very interesting way to get into this because this is I know this is a big question for a period of time, and I want to be very clear. In no way am I trying to compare your character, the neo-Nazi skinhead, who is an absolutely thorough racist and whose character is just plain old disgusting.
Pretty damn despicable.
Yeah, right, exactly. But I kept thinking about, and when you talked about taking responsibility, the problem in this society these days, especially in relation to crime and imprisonment, when you have mass incarceration, you know, more than 2 million people in prison, more than half of them black and Latino youth, most of them, a lot of them in there for just pittance, you know, for minor crimes.
Sure.
But they're doing a lot of time. And when you add that up and there's no voice speaking out against us in any powerful way, that becomes really – that's a slow genocide that can very quickly turn into a mass genocide. And I kept thinking about this in relation to, you know, the question that was posed about – for you, Mark, about the thing of you know, you want to be tried for the crime and not for the ideology. Well, these are people who are being tried, thrown into prison – not for the crimes, but for the color of their skin and the people, the section of society they belong to, and the fact that this society no longer needs those people and wants the idea is to keep them downpressed. And I saw there was a very big importance in terms of thinking about that and in relation to that, because the play is about transformation as well and the fact that people can transform. Mm-hmm. You know, can either one of you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, prison is a horrific place, and people do go through massive transformations. People get sober. People find God. People can, especially Mark's character, Mike is young enough that given attention and counseling and education and rehabilitation, something we've sort of lost sight of in our prison system, there's the possibility of transformation, of redemption. And mostly in our – and now, again –
for those
the
willing
Canadian
to grab
system,
hold of it.
Right.
You know, if you're – you know, if only once you recognize – what you've done and the fact that, oh, maybe there is something wrong. Maybe there is something inside me that needs to change. It has to happen on an individual level. And I think that's where the punitive system we have in place is flawed, because it's applying, you know, austere measures across a wide spectrum and not really looking at individual cases. What do the individuals need? What were the social preconditions that led to these There was a woman last night who
we have a discussion after every show. We're also offering 2 hours of live continuing legal education ethics credit for attorneys who want to come and see the show and participate in the discussion about the legal ethics and morality of some of this. But there was a woman last night, who was saying, well, come on. You described these steel-toed boots. You kicked a man for 3 minutes. How could you not know he was going to die? I mean, shouldn't he be punished? I mean, she was outraged.
She was pretty furious. Yeah.
Not at the racism of white supremacy, but at this guy, this drunken guy who kicked someone.
But see, here's the thing, and this is unfair, but I'm going to do it anyway because
Please.
We're going to run out of time real quick. But that's right. one of the things that I was thinking about the reason I raised that question is because, look, these are people that are put in prison today, and black youth in particular, are constantly demonized as the worst possible section of people. They have no morals. They'll do this. They'll do that. They'll go out and sell drugs.
No families. No education.
Right, exactly. And here's a system that created the conditions, which I thought was actually with your character, Mark, there's some truth to the fact that the system creates the conditions that people then try to deal with. But the point is that people can be transformed, and I think that's extremely important because prison isn't at all about transformation. Prison's about punishment.
Right.
It's about incarceration for punishment. And at this point, it is. As I firmly believe it's part of that whole slow genocide program that's going on.
I completely agree.
I think it's particularly interesting and honored to be on here on the International Day of Peace as well. So thank you for having us.
All right. On that note, we have to wrap up or we'll be run out of the studio. So, Alan, Mark, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Take care. All right. We've just about come to the end of the show. But before we wrap it up, I want to go back a little bit to the middle of the show when we were talking with Sandra Thomas, the mother of Alicia Thomas, who was executed by the Los Angeles Police Department. And thinking about that, I remembered a comment or an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian. This excerpt was called, "Yes, There's a Conspiracy to Get the Cops Off." And I kept thinking about the question that Sandra Thomas posed. Why is it taking so long to figure out what they did? It's clear they murdered my daughter. Why isn't anybody doing anything to make them stand up and pay for murdering my daughter? Those are the questions that are being posed countless times over this country. And Avakian's excerpt about a conspiracy to get the cops off, which is taken from the talk Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About, and it can be found at revolutiontalk.net. This excerpt, A Conspiracy to Get the Cops Off, speaks right to the heart of what's going on. So check this out.
Think about what happened to Amadou Diallo in New York. Now, Richard Pryor used to have this routine he did to show what it was like for a black man just in an ordinary encounter with the police, how you had to try to avoid being one of those mistakes where you got killed. He'd talk about a black man gets pulled over by the police, and he has to say, "I am reaching into my pocket for my license because I don't want to be no motherfucking accident." You have to show them and make clear and loud that you're going into your pocket to bring out your wallet. Otherwise, they'll say you had a gun and shoot you down. And for Amadou Diallo, even that didn't work. Amadou Diallo pulled out his wallet and held it up, and they shot him down anyway. 41 times they shot at him. They pumped his body with bullets. Or look what happened around here to Taisha Miller. The police came up on her. She was in a car, apparently passed out. Her family came up. They begged the police because the car was locked, let them find a way to open it. But no, the police couldn't wait. They fired into the car 29 times, shooting her in the back 12 times. And that wasn't the worst of it. When the family came and was grieving, the cops started mocking them with racist taunts. Oh, what is this, Kwanzaa? What is this, the Watts whale? This is America. This is the greatest of all countries. Well, what about what happened with Donovan Jackson and how the cops got off on that thing, too? They took him, they punched him in the face and slammed his head down on a car for no good reason and no reason at all. But they got off. One of them got acquitted completely, and the other one, oh, you know, the jury couldn't decide. But let's not blame the jury as much as the judge and the prosecutor. Whenever they're forced to put a cop on trial for brutality or murder, all of a sudden the prosecutors forget how to prosecute. Anybody who has a case, I'm sure they say, God damn, give me that prosecutor when I got my case go up. They don't call witnesses. They don't ask the witnesses the right questions. They accept the defense theory of what happened and then argue little nitpicky things about it within that framework. The same thing happened with the Amadou Diallo case. The jury found him not guilty, and one of the jurors afterwards said, I wish we could have found him guilty. I hope they sue him, those cops, and get all kinds of money out of him. But the way the judge set it up, we had to go by the law, so we couldn't find him guilty. Well, they should have found him guilty anyway, but you know what she's saying. And the judge is part of it, too. It's part of the conspiracy. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off. Look what happened in the Rampart scandal, a scandal in L.A. They shot up this dude, Latino brother. Then they accused him of assaulting the police. He comes into court in a wheelchair. He's convicted. The judge gives him almost a maximum sentence. Why? Because he didn't show remorse. For what? He didn't do any goddamn thing. But this is the way it works. And what happened when they finally had to put these Rampart cops, or a couple of them, on trial? The judge did everything she could to get the jury not to find him guilty. But this time, the jury found him guilty anyway, so the judge threw out the verdict. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off.
All right, once again, yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off. That's the title of this excerpt from the talk Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. It's a talk by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. You want to hear the whole talk, or you want to just listen to a bunch of excerpts, go to revolutiontalk.net. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my guests today, Larry Everest, Sandra Thomas, Alan Blumenfeld, and Mark Cecil. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. I also want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and my production assistant, Henry Carson. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a song I just recently discovered. It's from Jimmy Cliff's new album, Rebirth, and it's a song called Ship is Sailing. Check this out. Sitting on dry dock, and it seems like all the pathways are